Welcome to eHealth Learning, inspiring professionals worldwide.
It is all of this knowledge about the anatomy and physiology of migraine. And now what do we do with what we know, which is the most important piece? And I'm so excited to speak with you folks about it. So the first 2 hours, we talked about the anatomy of what's actually happening with migraine. We talked about differentiating it between tension headaches, cluster headaches, how it's different. I'm wondering if you folks remember, like, how is migraine just a little bit different than, let's say, a tension headache? Do you folks remember some of the defining features? Just to quiz you a little bit, you can use the chat box if you'd like. Yeah, it's throbbing, unilateral, very common. Yes, love it. What else do you guys have? Just so far, unilateral throbbing. How about particularly worse with motion? Head movements, very good, Lucy. Yes, yes, head movements. What about some GI stuff, right? Could have photophobia, phonophobia, yep. Hyperosmia, very true. That's not always present with migraine, but it can definitely be present. Doesn't like change. Oh, I love that Bento put that one. Yes. So migraines do tend to happen in females more than males, for sure. It does tend to have a huge genetic component. About 20 different genes are associated with migraine. It is a standalone, which doesn't necessarily mean it coexists with other things. It can coexist with other things, but it's its own standalone disorder. Definitely linked to gender, very good. Definitely linked to genetics. Nausea and vomiting, that's one of the ones I was looking for. Yeah, definitely. So there tends to be a multi-system effect that's happening with migraine. And a migraine can exist independent of other diseases. Mine actually exists independent of other diseases. So it's very fascinating to learn more about migraines. I'm so excited that you folks remember so many good things. Someone mentioned the dura mater. Yeah, that's where the pain is actually from, where it's emanating. It's we talked about the trigeminal nerve, the trigeminal nucleus, right? And how it gets hypersensitized. And there's a cortical spreading depression that occurs either directly to the thalamus or from the trigeminal nucleus. And with that cortical spreading depression, you end up basically having a decreased polarization of cells. And that initiates this big response to the dura mater. And since the dura mater that's supratentorial, like this region here, that dura mater is innervated by trigeminal nerve, the body will start to have an enormous amount of pain associated with that. And that's largely due to a particular neuropeptide that's released from the trigeminal nucleus called calcitonin gene-related peptide. But also there's a whole, what they call the inflammatory soup that promotes the pain that's associated with migraine. Very good, folks. It sounds like you guys retained a lot, which is amazing. Some of the other symptoms, just to kind of share with you folks. Can you guys see? You guys can't see my screen. Hold on one second. Let me see if I can show that. There we go. And so just some of the other things that kind of go along with migraine. Some people have brain fog, but it's actually not always present. A lot of times they're just foggy because they're in so much pain. But typically there's a unilateral throbbing sensation to pain. There can be photophobia, phonophobia. Sometimes there's numbness and tingling, but there's a lot of times an association with a problem upon movement of the head, and there is a unilateral component to it. So we got the symptoms down, right? We can now kind of orient ourselves around migraine. Now, how do I distinguish it from other headaches? Because that of course, you know, distinguishing it between the tension headaches we talked about was a good one. But what about this? So let's bring this up. So if you look at this little flow chart that was produced by Good Housekeeping, a magazine, I really liked it. I really like how they start here. are you in so much pain that you cannot really go about your day? Migraine will always send you to the left side. It's really, really hard to carry out your activities of daily living. Does the pain pass within minutes, like 20, 30 minute period? That would be more of a cluster headache. If it does not pass, it tends to be more migraine. And is it associated more with a particular event than it's episodal migraine? Or if it doesn't, it's more chronic. And so chronic can be more than five of these headache days per month when you start to get into chronic land. And we certainly don't want it to be more than five. Other types of headaches are not like things that are very uncomfortable, like sinus headaches and tension headaches, but they don't fit the exact profile of migraine. So having a headache specialist actually diagnose you can be a really, really helpful piece. So if you have migraine and you have not yet seen a headache specialist, it can be super helpful. And typically headache specialists are neurologists. But you want to go to one who's actually done fellowship in headache, or, you know, you get, actually can find someone near you that's a headache specialist. It just gives you a nice proper diagnosis. Someone mentioned aura. Aura is not present in 2/3 of migraine sufferers. So I wouldn't use it as your distinguishing factor of it. You can also have aura and no migraine. So aura can be present, just like some of the other symptoms can be present. But when you're looking for the big things that really distinguish migraine, it's a unilateral presentation of throbbing pain, worse with head movements, photophobia, phonophobia, and nausea and vomiting are typically present. Okay. And we were talking about the Duramater, and just, you know, a lot of the therapies that we're going to be talking about are going to be affecting the trigeminal nerve sensation, as well as the Duramater. And so just wanted to pull up a picture of that from, I believe this is Netter. No, it's not. I'm sorry. It's Tima. So this particular picture is quite lovely, where you can see that trigeminal nerve is innervating the majority of the dura mater that you see over here. And we talked about this in the first talk. You can see trigeminal nerve kind of edging out here. Ironically, it's kind of hammered down by dura mater. And so some of the techniques that we'll talk about may just decrease the total amount of trigeminal nerve sensitivity. And that's something that we want to focus on, is trying to not let trigeminal nerve get hyper excitable. And then, because that basically will encourage hyper excitability of the system, and then eventually cortical spreading depression, which we discussed. So does anybody have any questions about those basics? It sounds like you guys really retained a lot. And as we go into the triggers and treatments, triggers, prevention, and treatments, I just want to make sure that you guys understand why we go to what we go to based upon what we discussed in the first 2 hours. So it's going to take a second. We'll make sure you guys are focused on what we covered the first 2 hours. Everybody's feeling pretty good? Okay, I don't see any questions coming through. If you do, then, oh wait, one question. That picture of the skull, is it just the blue, red, and green nerve bits that are, trigeminal nerve is mostly the anterior and middle cranial fossae, and then everything up here. The posterior cranial fossa that you saw in the back, that's upper cervical nerves and vagus nerve. And so we'll talk about how vagus nerve plays a role in migraine. It doesn't play a direct role, only an indirect role, but what we call supratentorial dura, so things that are above the cerebellum, so the area here. That's a lot of people's migraine is very cranial, scalp oriented. And that's what we call it, allodynia, right? Very, very painful to the touch scalp. And it can include everywhere that trigeminal nerve innervates, right? One half of the face, basically. But yeah, the posterior elements are not innervated by trigeminal. That's vagus and the upper cervical nerves. Yeah, no problem. So when it comes to the triggers, we talked a little bit about the triggers on our first talks, but I just want to remind you folks that there are several, and you really do have to keep like a migraine log to find out what your triggers are. For instance, we know change is the biggest trigger of all of them. So not changing your environment and having a routine kind of schedule, like the patterns, right? Not just patterns of visual patterns, but patterns in life. We want to make sure that we maintain those things. Some people think their migraines are triggered by electronic devices, like the light emanating from the computer. I know we talked about that last time. Someone asked an amazing question last time about LED light or fluorescent light sensitivity. Really, if you know you're sensitive to those things, then you want to keep a consistent amount of that. I only notice when I have a change of light, when I go from incandescent to a lot of fluorescence, that can basically be a trigger. So you want to have a consistent type of light in your life if you can. Sleep, don't lose it. For people with migraine, they tend to want to go to sleep and have such a hard time getting to sleep when they have a migraine. It's the only thing that they think that helps them. Mostly because when you're doing that activity, you are not having to do anything else. And so it really does, sleep is very, very helpful. Also consistent sleep, that routine again, that change, changes in time zone, changes in sleep cycles, changes in time you go to bed. You really want to be very on point with this. I even go to the extreme of if I change time zones to sleep towards my time zone of home. And maybe that's a little uncomfortable, but it is not more uncomfortable than a migraine. So try to do your best to have a consistent sleep schedule. When it comes to the stress response, people talk about stress, and how much it increases migraine. I'm not going to argue that stress hormones are pro-inflammatory, and migraine can be seen, especially chronic migraine, can be seen as an inflammatory disorder. So that said, most people with migraine have the delayed stress response. When the stressor is removed, there's that change again, and then they experience migraines. So for me, like if I know, like right now I'm going through a very stressful period at work, I have a lot of pressure on me, right? And so I suspect that I could possibly have a migraine in my week off next week. So what I do to prevent that are all the management of the majority of my triggers, and then all the treatments that we'll talk about, how important that is to mitigate the delayed stress response that tends to increase migraine. The changes in barometric and temperature are big ones. So try to keep a consistent temperature in your life. Dress in layers. Like you'll see that I have like two layers on. And so if the temperature changes, I try to modulate my temperature because it's a big player in that hypothalamic-thalamic loop that occurs with homeostasis. The homeostasis is balance, right? It's the opposite of change. So we want to try to keep a balance. Food additives, we talked about last time a little bit, like when it comes to like additives to food, like MSG is documented to trigger migraine. It is very much encourages the inflammatory cascade released by trigeminal nerve. So monosodium glutamate or any kind of derivative of that you want to definitely avoid. It's just easy to just avoid takeout and avoid processed foods as much as possible. That'll solve the problem. When it comes to sulfites, like wine, I actually can tolerate wine now, but when I was younger, I couldn't. So if you're going to do that, just make sure you can, you know, have something preventative to help you. And we'll talk about some of the preventative measures here in a second. We'll talk about medications and things. Sleep apnea, we talked about how that increases trigeminal nerve afferents. So one of the big treatments I recommend to patients is taping their mouth shut and taping their nose open while they sleep. Sounds crazy, but research is very supportive that mouth breathing can encourage trigeminal nerve afferents. And if trigeminal nerve, we're trying to dampen down trigeminal nerve afferents, one of the ways you can do it is tape your mouth shut and tape your nose open, which is going to force you to breathe through your nose and not through your mouth. Most sleep apnea is encouraged by mouth breathing. So those are some major, major triggers. I'm just curious from you folks, if you folks are migraine sufferers, if you could share with me some of your triggers. Like for me, it's definitely the depression of a stressful period, the menstrual cycle, fluctuations in that, which I'm starting to get a hold of. Hormones, yeah, that's the big one because that's a change, right? The fluctuation of the menstrual cycle. That's why it happens to females more than it happens to males because we have a fluctuating hormonal cycle. Males tend to have a more even cycle through most of their life, and then women are just like woo. So trying to keep as much balance, knowing that there'll be an menstruating female, we're the most at risk for migraine because we have a changing cycle. Alcohol, alcohol can be a trigger for people, especially the ones that are sulfites. But I noticed that people with alcohol, it's kind of dehydrating. And so it can change some of the potassium, magnesium, sodium gradients. And so one of the solutions, if you're drinking alcohol, we'll talk about it, is taking some magnesium with it and potassium. That would be really, really helpful. Someone said a yeast extract. So you're finding your food triggers. This is really interesting. Yeast is that fermentation too. So that might be a problem with fermentation. You just have to take a log without being too obsessive about it because you can really get lost in it. You want to just try to keep a log of what is your trigger. And that's what I ask my patients. I'm like, do you know what sets you off? Get to know what sets you off so that if you do consume those things, we can do preventative measures to make sure that you don't have a migraine or if you do have one that is less severe. Someone says exercising too hard. I love that one. So exercise, ironically, needs to be done in those with migraine. But you know what exercise is really popular is HIIT training. Do you folks know that? It's high intensity interval training, which is pretty much the worst thing a person with migraine can do because it's up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down. It's all these changes, right? And so if someone pushes themselves too hard, do you guys see how that might encourage vasoconstriction, vasodilation? You want to be a little bit more even keel with your exercises. Like for me, kettlebell swings, they're very rhythmic and methodical. Even if I'm symptomatic, I still exercise if I can. And so if I start to feel those premonitory symptoms before I start to get laid out by it, I just try to go for a walk. I just walk with my husband, or I'll walk here in New York if I'm in New York, because honestly, the exercise is so good for managing homeostasis, but you can't go full throttle. We call it going ham, just going all out. You really want to have a more moderate, especially if you have autonomic symptomatology like nausea, vomiting, along with it, nasal congestion. If your autonomic system, if you do that kind of HIIT training, it actually can encourage dysautonomia. So it can cause dysfunction. And so that's probably why you get set off by the migraine. So something to know about yourself, that you need to take things a little bit more steady. Doesn't mean it has to be slow. It can still be good exercise, but it just can't be full throttle and then stop, start does not work for me. It's just not. I know that there's a lot of research that says, oh, it's good for your heart, it's good for whatever, but it's not good for someone with migraine. So there's that. Someone says chemicals. Yes.
Sorry to interrupt you. Is there anything that you could sit your device on in front of you?
Sure.
Just because of the camera movements. That'd be amazing.
Is this better?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
Still, thank you so much.
Sorry about that. Yes. So someone says chemicals, both man-made and many common scents. Yeah, you have to figure out if you get olfactory triggers by certain scents. For reasons we talked about last time, the fact that the thalamus is the relay center. Remember, we talked about it being the bouncer of the club. And so if the thalamus gets involved, which it typically is with migraine, you definitely want to consider reduction of anything that can produce too much afferents into the thalamus. You need like a chill, unscented life. I don't wear cologne because of patients anyway, because they could be allergic, but I don't tend to wear a ton of scents because for the same reason that you guys do, I can be not necessarily triggered by them, but some people really respond well to things like lavender and peppermint. There's a couple of small studies that support that they are quite good for migraine, but I have not found that to be true for myself. Someone says their neck being out of alignment. So we'll talk about some of the biomechanical triggers. I'm a chiropractor, right? And chiropractic in the research is not super great for migraine as far as a treatment when you're acute, but as far as preventative, I think it can be part of things like all the biomechanical management of the upper cervical region, the full body management of how the jaw sits in relationship to the entire body can be huge players on your ability to decrease total trigeminal nerve afferents. Balance, right? So I love the word alignment. You know, you want everything lined up so that nothing's taking too much of a hit. And so a lot of my migraine sufferers will talk about the computer setting them off. And I'm like, well, is it the light or is it the posturing? So it might be a combination of both of those things, right? And the stress associated with, you know, constantly working behind a screen. So, it's something we've all done this last year. So it's something to consider. Someone says strong smells trigger a terrible headache. That's not always migraine. No. Remember, headache and migraine are not the same thing. And I think we covered that very, very well in the previous lecture. So maybe if you're not sure the difference between a headache and a migraine, go back and listen, right? Because they're not the same at all, right? Very good. So now that you guys have shared to me your triggers, which is great. The triggers can be different for so many people. I've had somebody tell me that a certain smell of soup made them trigger migraine. Like when they eat meat, when they don't eat meat, like this, just a lot of different triggers. You just have to find what yours are and see if you can avoid them. And some things are just not avoidable. There's going to be times where you're going to run after the bus and try to catch it. And that might disrupt your homeostasis. And it may, you know, be a stressful experience. Maybe you blow a tire and you get into a car accident. There's going to be times where you can't avoid your triggers, your stress. So what we want to do is mitigate as much as we can, control as much as we can, and be able to provide an environment where not only can we do preventative measures, but also to sedate some of the high afferents into the trigeminal nucleus and into the thalamus. So what do we do other than avoidance of triggers? One thing that is underestimated is diet. And lifestyle change to make it more a routine is a really, really big part. And there's a couple of different foods that are really, really good for people with migraine. In particular, avoidance of triggers, which we talked about, wine, aged cheese, you know, neither one of those are a massive trigger for me anymore, but I consume both of those things on a semi-regular basis and they never trigger migraine. But in some people, it really does. So you just have to ask them. One thing that is really, really supported in research is magnesium. Remember how we talked about the cortical spreading depression? Well, that is a disharmonious relationship between sodium and potassium, and sodium and potassium can largely be mitigated along with calcium with magnesium. And so a huge amount of people with migraine are magnesium deficient. And so eating magnesium rich foods can be really, really helpful. A magnesium supplement can be very helpful. A lot of the research is on citrate and oxide forms. I never use oxides because they're synthetic mostly, but citrates tend to upset people's bowels. And for people with autonomic versions of migraine, you probably don't want to loosen their bowels up. Now, if they're constipated, they may like magnesium citrate. But if they tend to run with loose stools, you don't really want them to do citrate. I suggest magnesium bisglycinate. Magnesium bisglycinate at around, you know, 500 milligrams per day is usually what I suggest to people, starting them off on that. And it is very good to relax muscular tension that's associated with migraine, but more important, it's for the cortical spreading depression piece, just to balance out and slow down the big inflammatory soup response. Magnesium can be very, very good at that. Another very, very well-researched supplement is riboflavin, which is B2. There's a pretty good meta-analysis on B2 deficiency in people with migraines. So riboflavin, just, you know, you can look on your labels and find foods that are high in riboflavin. I take a supplement with magnesium bisglycinate and also B2. I've found them to be remarkably helpful. So much so without a lot of side effects. The only real side effect that you're going to get from magnesium is a little bit loose stool if you're taking too much. And at 500 milligrams, it's not going to happen unless you already have loose stool. And even then, 500 milligrams is too benign and too small of a dose. B2, it might make your pee a little yellow. My caution for people with B vitamins is just to say, look at your genetic factors. If you have MTHFR mutation, then you may not be able to do regular B vitamins. You might have to do the methylated versions of B vitamins. But other than that, you just want to make sure that you eat a good amount of protein. Like, people with migraine need protein to produce the proper neurotransmitters. And also, you want to eat a low glycemic diet. Remember, the fluctuations of sugar is really not good for someone with migraine. It's a really, really bad idea to consume a lot of sugar. It's not something that you want to have in your life. So just please consider decreasing the total amount of sugar that you consume. And if you do eat sugar, then eat low glycemic. For me, like, I take a berberine supplement to help me with glycemic index, and it really, really helps with fluctuations, just in case I'm eating on the go or in case I eat processed food, just to kind of make sure I don't have this big jump in blood sugar. People really talk bad about caffeine, but remember, caffeine should, if you're doing like a cup, I do a cup in the morning and I just don't let myself have any more or any less. The change is not good, right? Caffeine can be, you know, vasoconstrictive, right? Which can be really good for people with migraine, especially if they take it consistently. And coffee has all of these positive benefits, but some people, they like cut it out because they fear it's bad for them or what have you. But what's bad for you is a big change, like a big cutout. So be careful just cutting things out. And if people tell you, hey, you should cut caffeine out, it'll change your migraines. For me, like, I stopped caffeine for a year to see if it would change my migraines, and it made them worse because, of course, I quit caffeine. So just something to consider. You don't have to stop drinking caffeine. In fact, it can actually be helpful in the management of migraine because of its vasoconstrictive properties. So what's good for the goose is not always good for the gander. So just don't let anybody give you advice unless you've done your own logs and seen how caffeine does for you. But just a couple of basic things to consider. Make sure that if you don't consume vitamin D on a regular basis, foods that are high in vitamin D, like dairy, that you supplement with vitamin D3, K2. It helps with the hormones that we talked about, like serotonin, the neuropeptides. It helps with the balance of a lot of different hormonal chemicals. And because migraines are a neuroendocrine issue, you definitely want to make sure you're getting enough vitamin D. If you have menstrual migraines, vitamin E is a crucial piece because of the balance of estrogen, progesterone, and the respective chemicals of the female cycle. I would throw in EPA, DHA if you don't consume some type of quality oil. I don't consume fish oils because a lot of times they come rancid to us in America. So I use an algae form of EPA, DHA that's really, really great. And the more normalized I get my cycle, the more I notice that I have, you know, more migraine or less migraine tendencies and less severe ones if they happen. So for those of you that are listening that have menstrual migraines, vitamin E is a big one. There are some studies that support that CoQ10 can be helpful. I just don't want everybody jumping on 50,000 supplements at once and finding out if any of them work. So I would stick to the ones that have the most research, which are magnesium and riboflavin, and then start adding in pieces here and there based upon your what may work for you. And so but the biggest thing I can tell you as a take home, if you're trying to keep it easy for yourself, if you're not used to giving a lot of nutritional advice to your patients, is add one thing at a time. And I tell them like one thing every 2 weeks, like add magnesium, see if it makes a difference. Add B2, see if it makes a difference. Add EPA, DHA, and vitamin E if they have menstrual migraines, see if it makes a difference. And then watch them do something consistently over time to see if things change. But you want to do those slow ease-in changes. Even a bunch of supplements being thrown at somebody or a bunch of medications being thrown at somebody can be highly disruptive to the person's homeostasis. Supplements are powerful. They're also not regulated. So you have to be really careful and you know, go a little easy when you're starting things off. Someone asks, can you please repeat what kind of magnesium? Bisglycinate, B-I-S-G-L-Y-C-I-N-A-T-E, bisglycinate. It's for people that have GI upset, and it's a lot of people with migraine, especially loose stools, it's superior. For people that with constipation, they can probably take magnesium citrate and they may even like the fact that their bowels soften with magnesium citrate. But as a rule, I just give everyone bisglycinate unless they tell me that they're constipated and they want relief of their constipation, then I'll have them do magnesium citrate. I don't ever do oxides. So only two I recommend are citrate and bisglycinate. So for what it's worth. So should we talk about medications? Maybe we should talk about medications, right? Because there are several medications. I'm fascinated by the medications I want to share with you guys. I'm not on any medications. And I've made a decision not to, to better understand them, although I'm not opposed to people using them. The reason why I personally have opted out of medications is because I tried them early on with a neurologist and he didn't really cycle me slowly up. And I think you do have to do that with preventative medications. And he didn't really do that. And I got really violent side effects, a lot of nausea and vomiting and also had like cognitive problems. And to me, it just wasn't fitting to my lifestyle. I think if he would have amped up slowly, I wouldn't be so risk averse to them. But I'm also trying to figure out things at a more distinct level to where I don't have to use medication. I prefer to use whole food-based supplementation, but that doesn't mean that you have to. So some of the medications that are the most supported are GABA agonists. And I don't know if you guys have heard of these for preventative medicine, but if you, let's say you are going to go have a wine tasting, right? And you don't want to have an acute attack. So you have decided to do preventative medications to help you. The GABA agonists are things like Topamax, Depakote. These are drugs that actually encourage the inhibitory neurotransmitters, and which kind of counters the excitatory neurotransmitters, especially neuropeptides like CGRP. So basically you bring GABA up and you bring the excitation down. Now GABA, you guys may know about, like if you guys ever get your spine adjusted, you feel that, or if you pop your knuckles and you get that like moment of relief, that's GABA. GABA is gamma aminobutyric acid. It's a neurotransmitter that is an anti-anxiety chemical. amongst other things. It also helps with a natural amount of vasoconstriction along with serotonin. Serotonin and GABA are your chief inhibitory neurotransmitters, which means they try to prevent a lot of hyperexcitation of the nervous system. This is in converse, if you will, to dopamine, to norepinephrine, epinephrine, maybe you guys know it as adrenaline, glutamate. Those are all excitatory chemicals. So with the excitatory chemicals, that tends to encourage that release of the CGRP and another substance P, other excitatory neuropeptides that can promote that dural irritation through cortical spreading depression. So you want to sedate that with some of these medications. The problem is that most people that have migraine are menstruating females, right? Which menstruating females means they can give birth. And so a lot of these drugs are teratogenic, meaning they can really hurt a baby if you suddenly get pregnant. So that might have been why I'd never had children, but since my migraine started in my 20s, I just decided not to because I was nervous that I might get pregnant. But also, it's, to me, it was kind of like, well, why don't I just bring GABA up? What are ways that I can do to naturally bring GABA up? And so for me, I ran my neurotransmitter profile because I was really curious. It's kind of like Dutch testing, only it does the entire HPA axis, the hypothalamus, pituitary, and adrenal axis. And so you look at all the chemicals and how they're related to each other. And ironically, I found that my period chemicals, like estrogen, progesterone, estradiol, they were all within normal limits. What was so interesting is that when my estrogen plummeted during premenstrual cycles, that's what, because I had a decreased amount of serotonin and GABA, they would plummet too fast too. And then vasodilation would occur because I didn't have the GABA or the serotonin to balance it. So what's so fascinating for people with menstrual migraines is that you can have perfectly normal period chemicals. And because you have these positive findings on the neural labs for the pituitary, you can end up with symptomatology related to your period when estrogen bottoms out. And that's a lot of people with migraine. They'll get it right before their period starts, right? When estrogen is bottoming out, progesterone is bottoming out. So that said, I started to say, okay, well, my periods are normal. This is great. Like, but I need to produce more GABA. So rather than doing things like Depakote and Topamax, which are, you know, these beta agonists, what can I do in my life to encourage GABA? And so for me, it was supplementing with glutamine and theanine. So, and also of course, magnesium and B2 and B6. So I used whole food supplementation to help bring up my GABA and it worked great. And so I think this is not something that's really talked about because the research articles really show that Topamax, this GABA agonist, and Depakote, another GABA agonist, these two medications are phenomenal. They're phenomenal at being able to help prevent and reduce the severity of migraine, but they have all these side effects. So I'm just like, well, if I can take theanine, B6, B2, magnesium, and a little bit of glutamine, and I can mitigate that myself without the side effects, without worrying about it being teratogenic, I'm going to try that first. And that's just something I've opted to do. You can also do those things and you just talk to your neurologist about it if you're on those medications for preventative. Preventative medications have to be slowly amped up. So please learn from my experience. If someone tries to put you on too much preventative medications, these GABA agonists at once, it can be really problematic. They also tried to put me on another medication with a lot of research behind it, and that's beta blockers. Now, I don't know if you guys have heard of beta blockers before. They're used for people with heart conditions due to the fact that they can encourage a slight bit of vasoconstriction. So it really helps people with particular heart conditions. The problem is you can't use a beta blocker, you know, for migraine without some side effects that relate to that vasoconstriction. So it tends to make people really tired. It does kind of reduce their anxiety a bit, which can be really nice. But for beta blockers, they made me really, really mentally foggy. And since I have a high cognitive job, multiple jobs that require me to be on point, including this one, it just wasn't a drug that I could medicate with efficiently and to really live my life at the fullest extent. So, but they're very commonly prescribed in America. That's called Imitrex. It's extremely commonly prescribed and it does help a lot of people. So those are preventative medications, not acute medications. Those are things that you do to prevent the severity and frequency of migraine. And they have a lot of evidentiary support. a lot of your patients are going to be taking some version of that, whatever country you're in, some version of that. an emergency medication is different. So for acute migraine, emergency medications are usually in the triptan class. And so these medications are 5-HT agonists. So again, they're encouraging the inhibitory pathway. They mostly do it through serotonin or through the inhibition of norepinephrine, or keeping norepinephrine on its receptor so it doesn't quickly try to release. And some people really respond well to these. These make me projectile vomit, so I can't take them. But one of their biggest side effects is nausea and vomiting. And I'm like, that's already a side effect that I have from migraine. So it's not really something I'm interested in, but it will help with the pain part. They're really, really helpful for people. And so triptans, if you ever talk to someone with migraine, they probably have one in their pocket or they have one in their book bag for if they get smacked, gobsmacked with a migraine, an acute migraine. I, again, don't control my migraine with that. I could, you know, I just decided personally not to. I do support people who take them, and I just want them to know how to mitigate some of their side effects by just making sure they have enough magnesium, making sure they have enough B2 and B6, making sure that they have enough GABA and running their labs just to see, you know, how they're doing with their neurotransmitters. That all can be extremely helpful. When it comes to some of the other medications that you may have heard of, like that are herbal and maybe over the counter, I don't know what you guys call it in Europe, but it's acetaminophen, caffeine, and aspirin together. In the United States, we call it Excedrin. And it's the only thing I take as far as medication for migraine, and it's magic. It's like this age-old recipe for migraine, and it's called something different in different countries, but the way that they think that it works is that acetaminophen is pain-killing, the aspirin helps with the vascular tonicity, and caffeine also is vasoconstrictive. So when taken at the premonitory stage, acetaminophen, caffeine, and aspirin can be really, really helpful. And in Chinese medicine, we have herbals that actually mimic that. So you can take an all-natural version if you don't like to take synthetics. If you're taking these things like daily to prevent migraine, it's terrible. You cannot take these things on a daily basis. They do have major effects on organs. Like acetaminophen is really, really tough on the liver. Aspirin can encourage your chance of gastric bleeding and hemorrhagic stroke. The caffeine is more benign than the other two, ironically, as much as a bad rap as caffeine gets. It's very benign compared to acetaminophen and aspirin. But these are all considered to be very, very safe. And for someone that experiences migraine as a chronic event, it is very handy to have those things on hand. So for me, I don't travel anywhere without Excedrin. It's in my coat pocket and it's in my bag just in case. And I take it as minimally as possible. To me, it's not something I want to be doing. And I definitely don't want to get any kind of rebound headaches from taking it on a repetitive basis. People tend to get repetitive migraines from use of Excedrin. I just worry about their stomach and their liver and organ systems. I don't think that you should rob Peter to pay Paul. So try to take it as minimally as possible. Other things, someone said, what about the rebound effect? We just talked about that. So yeah. So rebound headaches are just an increased frequency of migraine because you're taking too much medication. It's called medication overuse headache or medication overuse migraine. Great. So what else can you do? As a movement therapist, for me, it's like, what can I do to create the least amount of trigeminal afferents as possible? I'm very, very big on breathing. Although meditation doesn't prevent migraine necessarily, I think that breathing training can reduce the trigeminal afferents by encouraging someone to nasal breathe, to do all their inhales through the nose, to do their exhales through the nose or mouth, and then trying to get them to learn how to consciously relax some of the tissues around the head, neck, and jaw. Medications actually geared towards this are things like Botox. So you can do Botox. It's got a ton of evidentiary support that it helps people with migraine. Or you can also try to encourage your own sedation of the tissues through breathing training. My husband does an amazing course called Anatomy Angel Respiration Meditation. People don't need to do complicated breathing drills. They need to do consistent breathing drills. If you're a migraine patient, then for the migraineur, you have to do consistent breathing training. Like for me, it's just like, I do it every single day. And I do notice a decrease in the total amount of migraines I get if I'm consistent about it. And I think that's got to do a lot with me not consciously clenching my jaw, me not constantly building tension that might lead to increased trigeminal nerve afferents. So something to consider. One of my friends as a researcher said, meditation is like throwing water on a duck's back. It doesn't necessarily encourage the duck to swim, but it makes him more resilient to the water that he's in. And I really liked that analogy. So meditation is just a part of the lifestyle, you know, balance, the homeostasis that can be really, really helpful. Not to mention the fact that, you know, your thoracic diaphragm is controlling all circulation of your body. It's helping to normalize homeostasis. So the more you tune in to your breathing, the more you might be able to reduce some of the trigeminal nerve afferents. Our ID4 coursework talks about head, jaw, hyoid, and how to balance all of those. So when someone's a migraine sufferer, a migraineur, I put them through our ID4 analysis of jaw position, hyoid position, neck position, and how it relates to the abdominal lumbopelvic stability. And so someone had mentioned their neck being out of alignment. I'm like, that's really interesting. I never noticed that direct chiropractic helped me with my migraine, but that going to someone and getting, you know, consistently aligned, whether it's through, you know, CST, you can do craniosacral therapy, SOT, we talked about, you could do multiple therapies to encourage better alignment so that you're not overusing things in the trigeminal nerve area. That is something that might be really helpful. Another helpful preventative and treatment can be acupuncture. Acupuncture is shown in peer-reviewed literature to help reduce the excitatory chemicals and to increase the inhibitory chemicals. Same thing with chiropractic. Chiropractic does it too. Like chiropractic and acupuncture, they do help to encourage a better balance between excitatory and inhibitory neurotransmitters. And I think that, you know, your meditation does that, your movement training does that, your exercise does that. And so if you're going to really treat a migraineur and try to help them balance their chemicals, you would do as many things as possible that works for that patient. And so not that more is better, it's not. You just have to find out what works for that person. For me, chiropractic, ironically, I'm a chiropractor. Chiropractic does not help my migraine tendencies. But movement tends to, like me doing balanced quadruped movement with nodding, just to decrease some of the total amount of tightness I have around the neck, and then building up upper body power and building neck flexor strength. In headaches in general, and I'll share this article with Andrea so you guys can read it. In headaches in general, it's shown that people have decreased neck flexor strength. And so getting someone on all fours where they're building up upper body power and getting them to learn how to nod. And I have them do this when they're at their desk too, on their elbows, just having them learn how to decrease their total amount of afferents and just try to relax through the upper body. I'm my body in particular is extremely responsive to really gentle exercises. There's some really nice research to support that restorative and hatha yoga can be very helpful. I think the breathing and the slow movements, the body awareness and the mindfulness can be really, really helpful. You really have to find some things that work for you. For me, like slowing the F down and becoming more aware of my breathing. And for me, like I was just dissecting for 8 hours before this talk, right? And so every 45 minutes, I set an alarm to go off. Like a Pavlov, right? Because I knew that I was going to be in the cadaver possibly like this, right? I'm like, that's not so good for my migraine. So every 45 minutes, my beeper would go off and I would do my get-ups. And so it's a human ambulation practice like a baby does. And I would just be aware. I would just bring mindfulness into my practice. And while I'm dissecting, I do breathing drills and I listen to good music. And I'm like, I know that the smell is a trigger and I know the positions are triggers. So if I know that these are triggers, what can I do to decrease the triggering? I took my theanine, I took my magnesium, I took my B2 and 6, and I feel freaking great, you know, and I expect that, you know, next week when I have the stress off of me is when I'm a little bit more susceptible. So I just need to make sure that I'm consistently doing some of these things to help myself. And that can be all the difference. Someone said, Excedrin, let me spell it. It's just a brand name. Just look for migraine over the counter. In different countries, it's spelled differently, but it's what I would consider my emergency med. It is approved for acute usage. It's not approved for preventative. You don't want to take it on a regular basis and hope for the best with your migraine. It's not a good idea. Then you can improve that rebound effect, and you don't want to really increase the rebound effect on yourself. But when it comes to treatments, another thing that's really, really growing in the medication world is CGRP medication. If we can inhibit that neuropeptide in the inflammatory soup, then maybe we can prevent migraine altogether. It's very new. The medications are really new. And so the jury is still out, but it's a very exciting development if we can actually stop migraine before it even becomes an entity. They're talking about doing, you know, those things via intranasal and like a cannulus, so that you can get to the sphenopalatine foramen, that part of the trigeminal nerve connection. There's other medications that they use that are IV related. I have never gone down that route with the ergots and the anti-nausea medications. Luckily for me, I've been able to manage with the things that we are talking about, but people that have really severe migraines, some of them do have to get IV ergots and antiemetics, and oof, they can be really, really bad. So that said, those are all out there. Another really exciting one is not just neuromodulating with medication, but neuromodulating with magnets and with electricity. So in Chinese medicine, we use scalp acupuncture for migraine when someone's not in an acute event, and we add pulsations to it. And that seems to really, really help. And that's actually what got me into acupuncture, was the how much it helped with my migraines. They have these really cool devices if you guys have heard of TMS, transcranial magnetic therapies, what they do is basically they put what looks like a helmet on you, and it's got these magnets in certain areas, and it decreases the total amount of trigeminal nerve afferents. It literally inhibits that cortical spreading depression. And it's expensive and it's newer, but it's promising because it has zero side effects. I mean, we're talking less side effects than Excedrin. This is great. There's a device I want to show you guys. It's basically tying into noxious stimulus. And so if you see this here, what we do is we jolt you at certain areas, what it can do is it create an inhibitory cascade of this trigeminal nucleus. Right? So if we know that the brainstem is where a lot of the stuff is going to mitigate to the thalamus, if we can inhibit that before it goes to the trigeminal nucleus, then can we actually stop it? And so a lot of this uses vagus nerve pathways. And remember how we talked about the cold on the face, like putting a cold pack can be really, really helpful to help with migraine for the trigeminal cardiac reflex. That's trigeminal and vagus nerves. So the two nerves, they're very synergistic in a way. And then they antagonize each other in this really, really important way. And so if we think of trigeminal nerve as being this increased inflammatory cascade, we think of vagus as being a dissipation of that, right? People with low vagal tone tend to have things like acid reflux, right? What do you put somebody on acid reflux on? You put them on probably a PPI, a proton pump inhibitor, and you put them on an SSRI. You put them on something that boosts serotonin. So if vagus encourages serotonin release through the gut, where 70% of serotonin is located, increases GABA, then if we can increase vagus, we can decrease the trigeminal afferents and just balance it out a little bit. And so they have this device called Cephaly, which is supposed to encourage the vagal tone. And they put it right on the trigeminal center, right? So V1 center, ophthalmic division. And if you have migraine symptoms, you're supposed to like hit it. And it through magnets or electricity, you can create like an interruption of the trigeminal signaling. It's kind of like, do you know how like when you cut yourself and you put pressure on it to stop it? It's kind of using a different pathway to trick the brain into down-regulating its responding system. So they're starting to believe that migraine is partly a learned behavior. Yes, there's this huge genetic component to it. Yes, there is a gender component. And yes, there is change components to it. But there's also this learned behavior of migraine. They think that they can break it. Like a Pavlovian dog, you're supposed to hit this thing. And then via magnets or electricity, you can interrupt the noxious stimulus. So the research is still coming out for those, but I'll include some research on neuromodulation if you want to read about it. You can actually get these devices from your neurologist, and some of them you can buy online. They're really expensive, but you can give it a shot. For me, I'm just going to use acupuncture and needles and use an electric stem on them. And that can be just as effective. But it's very, very promising, and there's no side effects, no side effects. You're not going to cause damage to other systems, which is a really important piece. Someone asked, I'm working on vagus nerve with some therapies like Bowen, whatever you have in your army. There are so many ways to work on vagus nerve. The best way to work on vagus nerve is breathing. There's no better way to work on vagus nerve than breathing. And for us in ID, immaculate dissection, we work on the vagus nerve pathway. In our ID5 course, we talk about nerves, and we really focus on getting the vagus nerve to be in a good position along its path. And I've dissected a lot of vagus nerves, over 5,000 of them. And let me tell you, that nerve is called vagus for a reason. It's the vagabond. It's the wanderer. So getting it to floss and to move freely is a really big challenge. And it's a challenge all the way from the intracranial aspects all the way to the midgut. So it stops at the transverse colon here, right? So it's, you know, powerful. So whatever vagus nerve tonicity drills that you have are great. Heat shock proteins. We talked about the, you know, difference between heat and cold can be really wonderful for vagus. The vagus nerve stimulators are new and brewing therapies that are wonderful. Acupuncture with electricity especially is fantastic. Magnets are amazing. Bowen, ID, whatever you have in your army to reduce vagal tone. The number one thing you should probably be doing to improve vagal tone is breathing training. It seems so easy, and yet people do not do it. Believe me, my husband will tell you, he's a breathing coach, and you wouldn't believe how many people book one appointment and that's it. And they're just like, I can't do it consistently. And I'm like, well, then you don't want control over your migraine. So for me, it's non-negotiable, like teeth brushing. It's like, that's the best way to improve vagal tone. Just doing some basic inhale, exhale with a 1-to-2 ratio, inhale through the nose, exhale through the nose or mouth, preferably all through the nose if you're a migraine sufferer. And that consistent 20 minutes consistent. If you have a stressor, like for me, turbulence is a horrible stressor. The plane itself is not a stressor for migraine. The turbulence can be. So I'll do my breathing training when I experience turbulence. If I have a boss that's mean to me or something, I'll do some breathing training while I talk. If I have a patient that's really difficult, then I'll be like, okay, I can manage myself better by doing some breathing training. It's something that I go to on a very regular basis to help with vagal tone. So trigeminal nerve is not your enemy. It does seem like it if you are a migraineur, but it really is about just getting the system to balance and to be able to adapt to change. So things to consider as far as diet, lifestyle, medication, manual therapies, exercise therapies, whatever you can do to create a more balanced system, a more balanced you will always be benefited with migraine. Someone says, can hyperexcitability of the trigeminal nerve cause hyperexcitability of other nerves in the body? Well, we described that. Hyperexcitability of the trigeminal nerve causes hyperexcitability of thalamus, and all nerves are read by thalamus. So the answer is yes. Yep. Trigeminal nerve is particularly in charge because it innervates the blood vessels of the head. So trigeminal nerve almost exclusively does that. So your body is very concerned with getting blood to your head. Your brain consumes 20% of your total amount of blood and oxygen, and it's only a 1/12 of your body weight. So yeah, trigeminal nerve is really, really in charge. And so if we increase hyperexcitability of that trigeminal nucleus, it can be a problem for anything coming into the thalamus. Someone said, would you recommend a blood test for magnesium deficiency? It won't show up. So they talk about this in the research, that magnesium is such a fluctuating chemical that the odds of you finding the person deficient when they have migraine, when they're having migraine, is just probably not going to happen. The blood test for trace minerals are really tough. You're better off using a little bit of magnesium and seeing if it helps the person. It's a trace mineral. It's a vital. It's really, really important. And classically with people with migraine, think the M in migraine is the M in magnesium. So along with, I don't suggest they run an electrolyte panel. It's usually going to show up inconclusive. Yeah. It's great. Well, folks, I have to run. I have to go to my other job, but if you guys have additional questions, I hope that you guys will email me. My email is drkathydooley@gmail.com. And I think I gave it to you guys in the previous weeks, but just keep it. And I'm going to send a bunch of research articles to Andrea to share with you folks in case you're interested in learning more, listening more, more in depth. If you want to go really, really deep down the rabbit hole of migraine, I would love to help with that. I do want to give away a poster to someone really quickly. Maybe you guys can answer a question for me correctly. Can you guys tell me the term for when there is a hyperexcitability of the trigeminal nucleus that results in a decreased amount of neuronal response from the occipital lobe that kind of comes forward anteriorly? Can you give me the 3-word phrase for that? And I will give you a free NERF poster. I will send it to you on Monday. First person in the chat. Because in the research, you're going to find this phrase used a lot. 3 words. Cortical spreading depression. Woo! Yes, it was Jacob. So Jacob, make sure that you email me, drkathydooley@gmail.com, and I'll send you out a poster on Monday, our ID nerve poster. And hopefully you guys, if you're interested in learning more about nerves, you will take the ID5 online course with us. We have webinars and such. But other than that, please check out the other embodied health learning talks about gait, talks about human movement, talks about limb, talks about pelvis. Our cervical thoracic series is great for people with migraine. Learn about the neck. You need to know about the neck. Probably eventually we'll do a TMJ one if I can convince Julian and John to let me talk about the TMJ, because that's a pretty big one for people with migraine. So would love to talk to you guys in the future more about how all these things tie together.
Thank you, Kathy. Wonderful. Yes, those are short course series that you can find at Embodied Health Learning and go to courses. There's a whole collection of them now with Kathy. We highly encourage you to look at them if you've enjoyed this one. Thank you, Kathy. We will be talking about other possibilities to offer to our members. And thanks for this hour today. And thank you all for attending. The recording will be up within a day. So you can record, watch the recording back and take notes to your heart's content. Thank you all.
Thank you.
See you soon, Kathy.
Bye, folks.
Bye, everyone. Thank you.